also spread on cropland. And so those nitrate molecules are also coming from manure. Wastewater management is a concern, especially inland, for ammonia in surface water. So that's a fairly particular thing. And then there's also the issues of consumer choice and food waste, which are kind of beyond the scope of this discussion. But it's just the point that what we choose to consume also has environmental and public health consequences.
I just had a quick question, because
yes.
I'm still circling around on the alfalfa issue.
Yeah.
So alfalfa was considered as feed, not as a nitrogen uptake or cover crop sort of mitigation for soil health. It's just planted for...
So in the mass balance, alfalfa is a source of the symbiosis. There is fixing nitrogen, so that's a source of it. I'm getting to the technological options, so you can it can play different roles.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing that became clear was that if we think of each of these, the leaks in the bucket. That those there are particular processes that dominate particular leaks and are in many cases, so for example, volatilization from manure is a big part of the ammonia problem. Nitrate leaching from croplands is over half of the groundwater problem, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So although it's complex, there are bigger pieces of the pie that we probably where we should focus first. However, so this is a study, Jim Galloway's University of Virginia, one of the leading authorities on nitrogen biogeochemistry. What they did was basically to take current technologies and say, with what's available in terms of increasing nitrogen use efficiency in cropland, manure management, wastewater treatment, and fuel emissions, they came up with a figure of 25 to 30% globally with existing technology. We did an even rougher estimate of suppose it costs nothing to adopt all these technologies. Everything on the shelf could just be thrown at the problem, particularly nitrate into groundwater. Even if all the technology we got costs nothing to implement and were implemented tomorrow, that would close less than half of the imbalance.
So in your manure management, which you know I'll refer to compost being the final product.
Well, sometimes it's spreading manure. I mean, predominantly it's spreading manure on fields. Am I mistaken?
I pause because, you know, with the Food Safety Modernization Act, spreading untreated manure in fields, I think, is unheard of.
Well, they're spreading it on, they're growing fodder. So they're maize fields for feeding livestock.
No, so most, most farmers, strawberries being an example, they don't even use animal-based compost because they're so concerned. They use, plant material. Based compost,
mm-hmm.
just as prudent avoidance. Mm-hmm. But my question here is, does that include animal-based manure and green waste manure? Is that all in that?
So green waste is separate. That manure is manure from livestock. We also, there actually is some data on pets. In urban areas and things like that. But when we say manure here, that's livestock manure, feces.
Okay, the reason I mention it is that, increasingly in agriculture, green waste is also used.
Now,
it's not strictly dairy-based compost because a lot of the dairy-based compost comes from the Central Valley, mm-hmm. where you do have the higher density of dairy farms, but in coastal area, you do have a lot of the solid waste facilities which are licensed for green waste production, and that's a significant tonnage.
Absolutely.
In the in utilization. So that's why
I wanted to mention that. Poultry manure is also an important part of this.
Correct. Yeah.
And I'd say one of the features of what we would consider success of 20th century agriculture, driven by cheap fossil petroleum, was the segregation of livestock and plant production in agriculture with specialization. And so one of the things that we need to think about is how do we reintegrate those processes so that dairy manure becomes a resource rather than a waste, and that manure more effectively substitutes for synthetic nitrogen. However, I'd note two things. One is that just because it's an organic nutrient source doesn't mean it's better in terms of nitrate leaching. And there are two reasons for that. One of it has to do with the release in the soil, placement in the soil, but also, I mean, one of the key technological challenges is, and we have research going on at our Russell Ranch facilities, how do we actually use organic fertilizers in drip irrigation, which is a huge challenge. But if we could break through on that, we could have the best of both worlds. We're not there yet. Okay. I feel like I should do a time check. Are we doing okay?
I'll let Chris is okay. the master of ceremony for this topic.
No, I mean, I love the give and take, but I want to respect everybody's time as well. So you'll find two graphics in the executive summary that look like this. These were super controversial. Even the icons we use to say advantage, disadvantage, none, we had to redo that several times. People found them very emotive. I'm not trying to make fun. We're trying to communicate in ways that people can actually hear the information. But so what this is, it's looking at down the left-hand side are the categories of evidence and agreement. And then it clusters different kinds of, this is cropland management practices and the fate of nitrogen. There's a twin of this for manure management. I want to say two things about this. One is, if you look at the column three things. If you look across, there are a lot of areas where in one row you've got green thumbs up, meaning an advantage, and red thumbs down, meaning a disadvantage from the point of view of the environment. There are trade-offs. That's the main takeaway from this. Another point is that column on the right-hand side with the black icons that's called barriers. There are reasons why some of these things are not widespread. And if the dollar sign is obviously an icon for cost. And you'll see a lot of dollar signs going down that column. Now, Chair Wolf mentioned European policy. Because of the European Union's commitment on some of these issues, Europe is way ahead of us on cost-benefit analysis of mitigation and also the cost-benefit of specific practices. We have done a good job in California on cost-benefit on the air side, very, very thin on cost-benefit in terms of the of water and nitrogen issues. So I wish as an economist, I wish I could say we really know, but there's a lot of questions that are unanswered. So that's an additional, not only do we not have enough technology on the shelf, but we don't know enough about what the costs would be for that technology to actually put in place, not to mention other questions. But we could spend a whole day discussing each of these. The other thing I want to say, remember the kind of the rules of evidence we used, published, and we closed it at 2015. So science and especially practice has changed, especially in dairy. However, the other thing is, so that's not necessarily reflected, but we also, I get criticized because people will say, well, it's on our website about how great this is. Well, if you're a commodity group saying we have this great technology, I'm sure they're sincere, but that doesn't meet my rules of evidence. Not saying this to criticize the public relations effort, but to say that we really have not had a comparable kind of independent critical assessment of enough of these interventions. So when people say, well, we have all the answers, I say, well, where's the evidence? And they will say, well, we're not there yet. So there's a lot of important questions still to be answered. Which is why, I just want to emphasize, this wasn't part of the assessment, but when we finished the assessment, we created what we called the Solution Center for Nutrient Management, which is intended to be a 21st century kind of extension platform, which would address some of the problems I just highlighted. So it's dynamic, techniques and understanding is changing. How do we, the assessment is a particular point in time, how do we keep it alive? So we've started this. You're welcome to visit it. It has information on it. This is my one plug. We've had a lot of difficulty getting funding to maintain this, so I don't even feel that we're doing it at the level that would be justified by the scale of the problem. But this is an effort to work with farmers, ranchers, extension specialists, various people in the private sector to identify solutions. Trade-offs. It's not just about going down, there's no silver bullets to this. It's not about just going down a checklist and saying, did this, did this, did this, did this. The most effective thing is actually, if you want to stop the leaks in the bucket, stop pouring so much water in the bucket, right? So it's about reducing nitrogen inputs to the whole system. But you can see, so minimizing ammonia from manure increases nitrate leaching and nitrous oxide. Reducing nitrate leaching from cropland can increase nitrous oxide. So those cut back and forth. There's another thing. Decreasing leaching inhibits flushing of soils. Nitrate's a salt. We haven't talked about the salinity problems in the southern San Joaquin Valley, which is something we also, as I know you know, we have to keep our eye on. Then there's combustion, wastewater. But it's important to have a... It doesn't have to be everything depends on everything, but there are certain key connections that anybody taking a serious effort to manage this has to understand these key trade-offs. So then the last chapter, the hardest chapter to write, was the one about policy instruments. Assessments don't make policy recommendations. There was only one policy recommendation that we made based on this, which was the state of California does not have enough comprehensive policy-relevant information to make informed policy on nitrogen. Okay. And we published that in California Agriculture. But what we did instead was to look at what are the objectives? I mean, sort of classic policy wonkish stuff. What are the objectives? And how effective have existing policies been? And what can we learn from past policy successes or failure in designing future policies? So that's assessment rather than advocacy. And these were the sorts of things that we assessed. So different instruments, which would be emission standards, tradable permits, auction-based contracts, and the criteria we developed. These come from kind of generic policy analysis, adaptability, the institutional capacity to actually make it happen, winners and losers, cost effectiveness, feasibility from a technological point of view, and effectiveness in terms of environmental objectives. So that's all laid out in the policy chapter.
So an interesting point there you made on the tradable emissions benefit. Are you thinking about the similar policies to cap and trade associated with, analog?
What we're doing, as I said, we're not making recommendations. Each one of these instruments has strengths and weaknesses. One of the weaknesses of tradable permits is you have to create a bureaucracy.
Sure.
The ones that probably come out the highest are either quantitative restrictions or some kind of financial incentives, either taxes or subsidies. I know that those are dirty words, but that's economics for changing the price incentives that people face.
But are either of those among the categories you assessed?
Yeah, that's emissions charges or abatement subsidies.
Now, I mentioned this because there's been a lot of, sort of high-level conceptual conversations mm-hmm. about carbon sequestration in agriculture and in using carbon sequestration agriculture with best management practice as a cap-and-trade tool if the price of carbon gets to a point where mm-hmm. economically it does make sense mm-hmm. to built the bureaucracy,
well,
as you mentioned. Soil health as a whole. Because that's the right hand, left hand. You know, we talk about nitrates and compost and some of the mm-hmm. issues, but mm-hmm. the other side is that it's a great carbon sequestration source, and you do have significant sequestration of CO2, mm-hmm. which helps the issue of the ozone depletion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sort of the... For in your field as an economist, you always say you're ambidextrous, right?
On the one hand or on the other hand.
Exactly.
Try. This isn't the two-handed economist. This is the point of these all have trade-offs, and we want to make sure that people who are designing instruments or doing real-world experiments understand as much about the potential pitfalls as possible. In terms of soil health, one of the things, so there have been proposals to invest globally in building up soil carbon. There are carbon-nitrogen ratios in the soil. One of the big weaknesses of that proposal is they haven't really thought through the carbon, the nitrogen implications of that carbon target. And if we try to pursue that carbon target with the kind of global rule of thumb of 50% of it's going to leak, we might put a lot of carbon in the soil, but we also might exacerbate nitrogen pollution. So again, trade-offs. It can be frustrating to talk with me because I can always point those things out, but I consider it a service.
That's fine, but the European model actually, you know, and I would submit that some of the European countries are taking a lead role in climate change measures. You know, there's been a lot of work done in the benefit of sequestering carbon and also with further studies done recently is that carbon-rich soil do reduce the leaching effect of nitrogen into the groundwater.
So I would say...
Marine Institute and Carbon Institute.
This is kind of, you've anticipated kind of the next wave of work we plan to do. Mm-hmm. I would say for California, taking seriously the role of California in mitigating climate change forcing, it's still the transport sector, power generation sector. The soil health is something that, the reason for doing that is, actually there are a lot of agronomic reasons for doing that. I think it's plausible but unproven, the actual scope for that adding up to something significant. Again, in irrigated, high-temperature agriculture, the carbon sink can saturate at a pretty low level. So this isn't prairie soils of the Midwest. It's not Northern European soils. So I think we have to be careful. There are all kinds of good reasons for doing it, but I think we have to be careful. And this is outside the boundaries of the nitrogen assessment, and it's I'm posing these as questions rather than results because this is what we're thinking about. But it's possible we're putting too much weight on those potentials. You know, in California, we have such a diversity of production environments that it really requires. This is my challenge with my extension role: is how do we translate these big picture points into practical things that matter here in this valley, and then the next valley is different, and the central valley is different in the north and the south. So sorry for the hand waving, but I guess I feel it's my job to be skeptical about everything. So the next round of skepticism is going to be applied to some of these things. Not to say they don't have merit, but let's actually quantify what the effectiveness is and what it's going to cost. But now I'm getting way off the topic. So we did look at these, and that's in the chapter. I said this was the hardest chapter to write. The first draft of it, we had to throw out. It was basically Econ 1A approach. This is not an Econ, even an Econ 100 level. Non-point regulation of non-point source pollution in a complex setting like California agriculture, that textbook hasn't been written. And so our effort, and with a colleague at UC Riverside, Ken Barenbaum, and I put a lot of effort into our effort to do as well as we could on getting the principles out there. And I will say, in the assessment, one thing was really clear. So voluntary education programs can have an important positive effect in support of other incentives, either regulatory or market-based incentives, but voluntary programs based on education just by themselves, there's no evidence that those things work. And for obvious reasons, those are the ones that people like the most. So we did, look, I apologize, I actually, the slide on the European assessment, I took out. The key thing there, though, in Europe, they have coupled compliance with various kind of nutrient management regulations with the carrot of their subsidy schemes. And we're kind of short of carrots. We don't have the same opportunity to link things. There are some conservation programs, obviously. It gets very complex when you start thinking about crop insurance, for example. There are efforts to make crop insurance actually create more positive incentives. There have been disincentives in the past, but we have a different set of levers than the Europeans do. I will say some of our European colleagues have been coming here to California saying that they are interested in our lighter-handed approach.
So could you clarify that again?
So they have a very strong monitoring approach.
Correct.
And at least among some of the academics that we're in contact with, I think there's real concerns about the cost of that approach.
Yeah, the farm incentives in the EU are very significant across all agriculture commodity, and you know in the United States, as you know the Farm Bill. If you look at the amount of money from the Farm Bill coming to California versus other states, you know we're a minority here, a little bit odd considering that California is a significant agriculture contributor.
I'm not going to comment on Farm Bill politics today.
Yeah, I don't want to go there. But the point I was making is that the model is very different.
Yes, absolutely.
And I was using the Farm Bill as an example.
Yeah.
Not to get into the weeds of it.
That contextual part. And so there are seven of these case studies that were written up. I left the European one out. The one I left in two U.S. ones. Probably the most successful one has been this new river basin, North Carolina. But that's not groundwater. That's surface water problems. The lessons from that were basically you've got to worry about these non-point sources. Can't get around that.
I have a question. I'm going to circle back to your comment about European researchers coming to California in particular, and I think that's very interesting to me because I do feel that especially coastal California is so complex in the diversity. But also in the successes of the tremendous level of production. So what are they coming here to look at?
Oh, so I mentioned there's been a European nitrogen assessment, which actually is much bigger than what we did. These are basically academic exchanges. They send our students to work with us. We go there, present at their conferences.
Well, let me ask it a different way. What do they feel they can learn from studying in California?
So what I think, so they have, and I know Chair Wolf has probably more information about this than I do, but they have a very, they've taken a very quantitative regulatory approach. And there are, in the short run, there are issues with that in terms of efficiency and costs. But then there's also, if you're living in a world in which even at no cost, we've only got half the technology we need, the problem with a rigid regulatory approach is that it can meet certain of the targets, but it also has a stifling effect on innovation. And so I think that one of their motivations is not just the bureaucratic cost, but it's also this question of how do we get the kind of dynamic. California, I don't know if people here appreciate it. I worked outside the United States most of my career. People look to California for inspiration. We're viewed as the most productive, the most dynamic agriculture on the planet. So people come to us and want to see what's California doing. And I don't mean just from a research point of view. I mean our whole innovation system. So this next generation of trying to get some of these big imbalances in our carbon cycle, our water cycle, our nutrient cycles, is we have an opportunity to set the standard and really to contribute globally to addressing some of these challenges. Does that help you, Ms. Hunter? Yeah, yeah. And I say that from the point of view, I mean, I'm the privileged guy who gets to think about these things on the decadal scales of, you know, making sure we're asking the right questions and headed in a direction that over the course of a research cycle is going to produce something useful.
And I totally agree with you that California has a place globally. It somehow it resonates culturally,
mm-hmm.
and in other ways, the size of the economy, and in other ways, taking an approach to particular long-term problems in ways that other states regard as actually being contra mm-hmm. to the status quo,
mm-hmm.
And yet we prevail, you know.
Well,
and I think we have a role to play, and in as regards to our farmers, and as you know, we're trying to solve a problem, but the problem is not to reduce agriculture in any way, shape, or form. We need it to grow, mm-hmm. we need it to be vibrant, mm-hmm. and we need to allow for that experimenting and seeking out new practices and new techniques mm-hmm. and utilizing new knowledge. So, you know, the way that we get there, though, I believe, is what this process tries to engage in. We are regulators, but mm-hmm. We are also collaborators with our ag community,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very difficult conversation, very difficult dialogue, because we do have different goals and missions. But in the end, and I think you, in your initial statement, you know, kind of lack of evidence is one of those barriers for us to move ahead with confidence, because there are enormous risks on all sides, for all stakeholders. And when it comes to human health, I think these efforts, and it is unfortunate that it takes so long for the publication process to move knowledge like this forward into the mainstream mm-hmm. so that we're actually applying it. That's just one of those things. Maybe in the digital shift, academic and peer-reviewed research may find itself pressured to work a little faster and keep up with the rest of the world.
Those pressures are there.
Yeah.
Whether it will end up in a good place or not is still an open question.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
But I'm happy to hear your spirit of collaboration. And I do think that, say, with the approaches that are emerging in terms of groundwater quality, much more of a regional approach or watershed-based approach, I think one of the things, rather than pretending we have certainty about what the right approach is, would be more of a sort of a locally driven experimental approach that if those things could, there's something called double loop learning. So organization, people within organizations learn from experience, you hope. But then there, the second loop is about learning about those other, it's integrating across many different experiments. And maybe this is a utopian hope, but if California could have a strategy in which a number of different efforts were undertaken to address these challenges, and then there actually were a structured process of assessing the strengths and weaknesses of those different approaches, I think we'd get to a good place for farmers, ranchers, and everybody in the state much faster.
I think that's our aim with the ag order. It just takes an extreme amount of patience and a lot of experimentation. And certainly, you know, we have a very diverse region, and every single ranch and farm operates differently and has different inputs and different goals and aims. And so it's just a matter of getting there eventually before we draw down all of our resources, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I think it's actually more realistic and more encouraging to have that recognition that it's going to take a commitment to build the trust, mutual respect, and evidence-based knowledge to solve these problems. And I'm actually almost done. Mississippi River, I mean, this is about, you know, voluntary efforts and skepticism about their actual effectiveness. So this is really my last slide, is to go back to this issue so there is this big challenge. We're very far out of any kind of mass flow balance in terms of nitrates going into the aquifers in this state. That's going to take technological innovation, institutional innovation, policy innovation, and a lot of trust and goodwill. At the same time, we have people who face a daily problem of access to safe drinking water for their kids. That, in the scale of an economy the size of California, is a very solvable problem. And I think it needs to be dealt with separately from the crop and manure management problems. So thank you. Sorry this got a little bit unformatted, but I appreciate your generosity both in inviting me, but also the attention you've given. It's great to have such a receptive audience. And I'm at your disposal.
So just briefly, I believe it is on. I think we are, at least in the Central Coast, I think we've grasped the point you finished with. We've grasped that it's a much longer process to solve the loading problem and have actually been, you know, made some very good starting progress in working with farmers on the immediate drinking water problem. Mm-hmm. I guess my concern is, and I think you said early in your presentation that essentially we don't have the tools.
We have maybe half the tools
to solve the loading problem.
Yeah.
That if there were no cost and we applied all the tools we have, we solve maybe half the problem, but we continue to increase load. And as a regulatory agency, we have many more sticks than carrots, which certainly makes it harder to build a collaborative atmosphere with farmers. And I agree with your assessment that we're not going to come up with all those tools, and neither is UC Davis or, you know, the academic world, that it really will involve incenting experimentation by farmers. So I'm just curious, in the work you've done on this assessment and in the case studies you looked at, you know, I think the fundamental problem is for us is our kind of overall approach has been use sticks to drive down the amount of nitrogen used by farmers. A fairly crude approach, but it's what we've had. And have you seen examples or lessons that would illustrate kind of how we could, with our limited array of sticks and even more limited array of carrots, incentivize experimentation by farmers to come up with better tools?
So that's a big question, and I'm sympathetic to your dilemmas too as regulators, and I'm as coming from a farm family, I'm also sympathetic to what farmers are facing. So there is a whole, it would be another big talk, but there's a whole field about innovation systems. And what we're really talking about is an innovation system that has reinvented California every generation or so. It shifted, though, from the commodities to the broader environment and public health, in part because the private sector is doing so much investment on the commodity side, on breeding and things like that. But also in part because of population affluence have accentuated these environment and public health concerns. But just to not do justice to a fairly complex topic, patterns of innovation in agriculture are actually not that different from high tech. And what's required to have rapid innovation, and by innovation, I don't mean just ideas, but things that are used and put into practice, is very close connection between the users. So in this case, it's the farmers and ranchers, because you're not going to get anywhere without them, and the researchers, and the policymakers. And there's a whole art and science about crossing those boundaries. But it's about rapid feedback loops, so people are rapidly prototyping new things, figuring out what works and what doesn't, and moving forward. So we're probably as well positioned in California to do it this seriously as any place in the world. I mean, this Solutions Center, that website, that design of that approach actually came from one of my board members who's a Silicon Valley finance person, and said, okay, these are the, when we do solution centers in Silicon Valley, they're basically three parts. There's one part which everybody knows, which is the web platform, right? But that's not necessarily the only part. The other two parts are, you have to have relationships with people. So it's the social network, but not the popular social network. It's actually people having relationships with each other. And the third part is actual places, like maker spaces, places where people hands-on get experience with new technologies and practices, kicking the tires, slamming the doors, figuring out so that it builds confidence for people to actually use those things. But all of those things have to have learning feedbacks. And one of the great things about California is our diversity means we can be running multiple experiments. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we're doing enough to learn. Whoops, now I'm getting excited. I'm not sure we're doing enough to learn from all of the experiments that are going on. But maybe that kind of a woolly response to your question.
And I would add to that in the concept of maker spaces, those are the RCDs, mm-hmm. and the technical assistance community, mm-hmm. that are taking research coming out of Davis, coming out of Cal Poly, Fresno,
yeah.
and moving it onto the field on a small scale for farmers who have the financial ability and willingness to take that risk. They're the leaders, and they're the ones that introduce and innovate. Mm-hmm. and make it possible for that, you know, the large scale, single little percentage over here, a small percentage of total crop production, mm-hmm. figure out how it works, and then move it out through the associations into practice. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that is what we hope for, and that is what we try to support. And I agree with you that California offers so much, and it's interesting to me, just made this comment yesterday. We have Silicon Valley here, globally, driving so many things, and yet I don't see interest or involvement, and maybe that's just because I'm not sitting in the right room, I don't know, but I would sure like to see more of our own innovation and really cutting edge beyond what we have any awareness of what's going on in that industry. Applied to drought, applied to treatment at the wellhead, things that are cost-effective and doable. And, you know, we're lucky we've got one pilot study that we're doing in this region with UCLA with remote operation for RO nitrogen removal for three very, very small-scale communities. Mm-hmm. It's going to take probably 5 years to see if it works. But if that project proves to be feasible, viable from a regulatory perspective, as well as from a technical management mm-hmm. perspective to assure water quality, et cetera, we could actually see this, you know, proliferate throughout California, and we know that we have probably 2 million or more people exposed to contaminated, mm-hmm. primarily nitrate contaminated water. So, you know, we have things in the works, and we're very fortunate to have UC Davis as one of those leading entities where the money hopefully keeps coming and the research is supported. So we really appreciate your perspective.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, and just, I mean, it would be remiss if I didn't mention our colleagues here at San Luis Obispo, Fresno State. I mean, the University of California system and the state colleges and universities are part of this innovation system too. And I don't see us in competition. I mean, we have collaborative and complementary roles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not everybody sees it that way. Mm-hmm. But if I may mention, I've been working for some years to kind of link Silicon Valley and Central Valley. And they're two very different cultures. Mm-hmm. Academics speak a different language too. That's starting to happen. There's a lot of mutual misunderstanding. There are things you mentioned, risk management, for example. Silicon Valley has its own very distinctive formula for managing risk, which has worked beautifully there. I don't see that working in agriculture. Mm-hmm. You don't have the high ROIs that they look for one thing. Mm-hmm. But, and you have a lot more fixity of assets. I mean, you couldn't have more of a slash and burn approach in the tech sector, and you're not really doing, private people who have means are bearing the cost of that rather than society. So there's a whole thing there. But one of the things that I think is relevant to this is the revolution in sensor costs. Mm-hmm. So we see this cost of various kinds of sensors, whether it's remote sensing. On the Russell Ranch facility, I put a pamphlet in. We have a 300-acre long-term research facility. One of our collaborators is NASA. So as part of their Earth observation mission, we're working with them in ground truthing new, very detailed broadband sensors that produce terabytes of data for which we don't even know what those spectra mm-hmm. mean. But the ability to be sensing data from the sky, sensing data from the soil, sensing data from aquifers, sensing data from my wrist mm-hmm. is coming very fast. Mm-hmm. And that, if I may, I hope I'm not taking too much liberty with your time.
I got a time check a little bit earlier, so I think we'll need to wrap
up. I'm just going to say that in terms of our regulatory approaches, we've in the past, food, agriculture, and policy has been very much information constrained, data constrained, a lot about uncertainty, mm-hmm. asymmetries in information. Potentially, those things are going to change very fast, mm-hmm. and we're trying to get positioned for that. I will tell you that it's really the major food manufacturers who are way out ahead in these applications because of they view it as a competitive advantage to be able to make value statements to their competitors, to their consumers about, there aren't kids drinking unsafe water because of the way our farmers grow. Mm-hmm. So there's an emerging dynamic in which, in some sense, the private sector is even more powerful in forcing change than public policy has been. And so that's something that I think we're all just sorting out. But there, the technology's here. What's not here is the issues about privacy, or we haven't solved issues of privacy, intellectual property, and the institutional framework. And, you know, one of the things that I think is a key is I think farmers and ranchers need to be the owners of the data that they produce. Mm-hmm. I was in Ireland. They have a strong food and beverage brand for Ireland. They also have a big tech sector. For some of their commodities, they feel the value of the data produced on farm could be comparable to the value of the commodities being shipped off farm.
Wow, yeah.
So, but that, I'm indulging myself a little bit, but I just want to put those ideas forward because in that world, policymaking and regulation will be, have very different opportunities. Mm. Mm-hmm. So, but I feel like I should stop. Thank you. I've enjoyed this very much, and I hope it's been useful for you.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. Also, appreciate the interaction of my colleagues. I think it made the presentation in bringing it to another dimension. At this time, I would like us to take a 15-minute break, and we'll reconvene at 11:45. Thank you.